This is a special podcast for the 23rd of March 2021, when the palliative care charity Marie Curie has called the UK to a National Day of Reflection. It's 1 year since the first UK lockdown for COVID-19 began. While we reflect together on the impact of the pandemic, hundreds of thousands of people are grieving the death of loved ones. In this longer edition episode, someone who has known extensive loss in recent years generously shares her reflections on death and dying. Listen, and please don't miss a word. What she brings is pure gold. This is much more than a teaching episode. It's a celebration of kindness, humour, compassion, strength, and above all, life.
Hi everyone and welcome back. It's Ting Tara again, the palliative care reg at BHRUT, and today I have Louise Head with me, and she is the associate director to the chief medical officer here, and she's worked in the NHS for 22 years. And Louise is here today sharing part of her story as somebody who's had unfortunately a number of loved ones die in the last few years, and we're really keen just to understand better what the experience of end-of-life care is like for people on the other side. So I'm going to hand straight over to Louise. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and why it is you're here with us today?
Hi Ting, I wanted to talk to you today really about my own personal experience with dying. I've worked in the NHS for probably about 22 years now in a variety of roles across the Trust. And over the last few years, I've had quite extensive experience of losing those that I loved. So I just kind of thought it might be helpful to talk about that to you.
Thank you.
So if I go back a bit, at the end of 2008, my dad died of a brain aneurysm. He was only 61 at that time. Mm. He was sick for a very short time, and I cared for him at home. He died just before Christmas. And then coming forward slightly, about 10 years later, my youngest sister died of metastatic breast cancer. Now, she was only 44 at the time, and she left behind a four-year-old son. She was sick for about 18 months, and although she was in and out of hospital a lot during that time, for her last months, we looked after her at home. Last year, my partner, Michael, died. He was 55. He had been suffering for some back pain, and he came here to this hospital where the team looked at him. Unfortunately, when he was scanned, he had cancer in his spine. He died only 4 weeks later, and three of those 4 weeks were spent here at Queen's, and his last week was spent at home with me and our daughter. Unfortunately, on the day Michael died, my mum started chemotherapy for lung cancer. She was very poorly during the first height of COVID, and that was a very difficult time for us. She was in and out of hospital, and obviously we couldn't see her at that time. But in the end, she came home, and my brother and I looked after her there for about 6 weeks. But it kind of became unmanageable for us in the end, and she did actually spend the last 4 weeks of her life in a hospice. So I kind of wanted to share really what I've learned about dying from that. So it feels like it follows some sort of pattern, and that might just be my experience of it. The timescales are different in all of the situations I've talked about, but at the end, it's kind of the same. Mm. There are markers that once you've seen them enough times, you learn to recognise them. I absolutely knew when Michael was going to die. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that insight is a good thing, or a bad thing, a little bit of both, probably.
And I think that's a really interesting thing to hear, because when I've looked after patients and family, there are some people who will say, oh, I looked after mum when she was really sick, so actually I think I'm starting to see some of the same things happening in you know, their partner or their sibling. It sounded like for some that that could be reassuring, because they kind of knew what to expect next, and it was slightly less frightening in that way. But for others, it was, oh no, now I know what's going to happen. And what kind of what kind of feelings did it evoke in you?
So I would agree with that. I would agree with both sides of that. I do believe so when someone is actively dying, it's kind of rough. And it's scary, and it's a bit rubbish.
Yes.
You know, and there are actually, you know, breakdowns in the body, you know, in their ability, you know, just things like not being able to go to the toilet anymore, not being able to eat anymore. That are really difficult to watch. And when you watch the quality of life taken away from somebody you love, no matter how desperately you want to hang on to them, you also wish for peace for them. You know, my sister, my mum and Michael disappeared before my eyes. You know, they were skeletal by the time they died. They'd long since given up eating, or you know, no, that's awful. It's dreadful. So the comfort comes once you do recognise it follows a path. I think there is a small comfort in the fact that you are used to what you're looking at, and you can almost think people might be out of their misery soon. But at each stage in the closing down of a life, I guess it kind of gets worse and worse, and in my experience there then comes an element of peace. So actually in all of those cases, the last day of all of their lives was much more peaceful than the run-up to it. Because they were closing down, I guess, but you at least know you're heading towards that. So yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword, really.
And obviously each of these experiences sounds like they were incredibly hard, and it would be really nice to know, I guess, like what helped you and the rest of your family at this very difficult time.
So kindness, empathy from those that were taking care of my loved ones, honesty, compassionate honesty, but most of all, kindness. It's huge. Communication was huge for us. So when the people you love are dying, all of a sudden your whole world makes no sense anymore. Everything that you everything you know, and every plan you've made, and every, you know, we plan for Chris, and all of that just instantly disappears. And you need something to anchor on, and the thing you need to anchor on is information. So you are completely at that time, not only are you powerless to help with the disease that might be killing someone, you are dependent on the clinicians around you to guide you and help you through it, because that's all you have to anchor on. So you need them to reassure you, and that may not be that they reassure you that they can cure someone, but you need them to reassure you that someone won't suffer, or, you know, that they'll do what they can for somebody. You need them to guide you to help you cope, and you just need them to talk to you. So there is nothing harder than sitting on a ward with someone just desperately chasing information.
Yeah.
You know, even a really short conversation can make a huge amount of difference.
Yeah.
Really can.
That makes, so much sense in what I see day to day as well. It's those updates, even if it's, you know, not every conversation has to be a huge conversation. It's just sort of catching up with recent changes or events or what to expect next, or, you know, a plan for an investigation that's happening next. Touching base, checking on how the patient is doing themselves, how family is doing. And what you said about sort of knowing that things will be addressed like symptoms, that there's never a situation where we, from a palliative perspective, would say there's nothing more we can do, because it's not true. We can always make symptoms, we'll try our best to make symptoms that bit better. So communicating that clearly to people, you know, I'm sure that's, you know, important. But also what you were saying about clarity and clear language, something that we've talked about in the past, many people, was use of the D words for death and the dying. And, you know, is that helpful? Is that clear, or is it just, does it just evoke too much emotion and you can't see past it? How does it land?
So so the first time it's floated is very different to what happens next. So my partner was diagnosed and actually told how sick he was on a surgical ward in this hospital by a surgical team. It was fluke. It was because we thought there was something very different wrong, and his scans and that didn't come back till later at night. And actually, that was the surgical team that dealt with it. Michael flourished on a surgical ward as much as that is possible under the circumstances. He was amongst people that were having much more run-of-the-mill operations and procedures, and they really felt Michael's pain. They really empathised with him. They were really great with him, as was the surgical team. Did they use the word death a lot in the beginning? No, they talked about how sick he was, but they didn't shy away from it when asked.
Okay.
So I would argue that was compassionate honesty in the beginning. They knew this was a youngish man who'd come in with back pain and thought he'd be going home. And it was very, very different. So I think it was moderated to be acceptable. Obviously, my background means that I was almost compulsed to ask the question. But I will say no one shied away from it when I asked. And that was hugely helpful to me. So being heartbreaking is very different to being, it helped. I knew what I was dealing with. We have a child, and it was right that my daughter knew what was happening too. And we made plans around the information I was given.
So certainly it's about, like you say, a compassionate approach and not just throwing it out there if it's not the right time. But equally, it enabled you guys to then think, you know, about priorities and have open conversations as a family.
I would say, I kind of just had a thought actually. I can tell you what was really shocking for Michael was the first time that a DNAR form was put in front of him. So, and this was a discussion I had with the palliative care team, and it was shocking for him. And actually, I did realise at that point, no one had categorically said to him, and I include myself in this, that this is probably what we are, you know, you are this sick that this is the appropriate action to take around this form. So that was really, really shocking for him. really shocking. So when you ask about actually using the language, I suppose we have to think, if we have a process that means that form has to be signed, I would argue we are then obliged to be brave enough to, because if you're brave enough to put that form in some front of someone, you kind of need to be brave enough to have had the run-up conversation first.
Yeah, it almost doesn't make sense to talk about the form if you haven't even considered, you know, deaf and dying before that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then just sort of going back to what you said about kindness and empathy, which is so important. And we talked a little bit before about not underestimating the small acts.
Yeah, that's true. I have so many memories of things that people did that that were almost there. They were either small acts of kindness by them or they were acts of bravery by them. But, you know, I can... So we waited to bring... Once we realised how sick Michael was, we wanted to bring him home. And we waited on a bed. And that's torturous when you're trying to get someone that poorly home. You know, and I just remember the occupational therapist who came every day, two or three times a day, who hadn't managed to get the bed but knew how much it meant to us, so came to tell us she was on it and she would keep chasing it. You know, when I waited for a place for my mum in a hospice, you know, the team that remembered to call every day... Now, bizarrely, to say we don't have a bed yet, but they remembered to call every day and tell us they would ring again in the morning because they knew that actually by the time my mum was going into the hospice, we were really struggling to cope. So they understood the need. I've watched care assistants play music to my mum while they did her personal care. And it seems tiny, but it's absolutely huge. It just is huge. I watched a palliative care consultant remove her badge the very first time she went in to say hello to Michael, because she knew that the word would terrify him. And they're tiny things that at the that storm that you're in mean the world to you. I used to have a volunteer that would leave a sandwich and a drink for me at the hospice because she knew it was a 4-hour round trip every night to see my mum. I never saw her. She would just leave it on the side for me. You know, I've had an ED consultant traipse around this hospital in his break trying to find a wheelchair with me. And wheelchairs are a nightmare in this hospital. Not in every hospital, somewhere, some places there is a system, but that's, you know, when it comes to really small things that make a difference, when you've only got weeks left with someone, actually it's obscene to spend 2 hours each visit, you know, 1 hour and then an hour later that night looking for a wheelchair to take them to a quiet place so that you can talk. They're tiny things, but they'd make a huge difference. I've walked the corridors of this hospital crying just because I can't find a wheelchair. And I was blessed that I have friends here that stepped up and said, I'll help you look for one. But not everyone's in that kind of situation.
Yeah, and I've heard it said by consultant colleagues in the past that sort of one of the worst things you can do for somebody if they're, you know, dying is to waste their time because it's so precious. And I think that really highlights how important these quote-unquote little things are, which from, you know, from the other side, from the healthcare professional side, we can think, oh, I don't have time to go look for that, oh, somebody else can go do that, but actually it's enormous. Like if we do it, it makes a huge difference. So not to underestimate the value and importance of these little things.
I mean, another thing that may sound odd that makes a massive difference in these times is humour. So So my partner was a funny guy, and my mum was funny, and my sister did stand-up comedy, so
wow.
She was really funny.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't become a different person just because they have a limited amount of time left to live. Yeah. And and they hate to be defined. Every experience I've had is that people hate to be defined by the illness. My sister was fixated with people sending flowers to the house because it defined it. It was people sent them because she had cancer and she hated it.
Mm.
We do need to remember people are still the person that they always were.
Yeah.
And actually their families are the people that they always were. And when everything's in turmoil, a piece of normality is huge. You know, one of my closest friends is a doctor, and he has been with me through all of these losses. And actually his absolute fearless approach to being able to make a joke in the darkest of moments has often been my salvation. You know, there was a nurse on the ward when Michael was really sick, and he had an ascites draining, and it was gruesome. And she used to just tell him every day how kind of hot he was looking, and that, you know, and look at how slim you are, you're looking fantastic. And she used to make him laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and those things are really, really important.
Yeah. I think that we, again, as healthcare professionals, have such a fear of saying the wrong thing, or, you know, it's a very serious situation, it would be improper for me to try and crack a joke. But like you say, you know, illness doesn't stop that person being that person. It can sometimes make it harder for that person to really concentrate on the things that make them them. But part of our job is to minimize symptoms and, you know, suffering, distress, so that they've got the energy and the brain space to
absolutely.
Be them. That should be what we're trying to bring to the fore as much as possible. That's so many pearls of wisdom that you've given us. And I guess, you know, we've talked about healthcare professionals being anxious and not knowing what to say, because it is unfamiliar territory for a lot of people, maybe slightly less so now after the pandemic. Unfortunately,
yes.
A lot of us have seen a lot more death and dying. But what would you say to people who say, oh, I can't do this, I don't know what to say?
So I totally accept that that talking about death and dying is really, really difficult. You know, it's difficult in a personal life, and it's difficult in a at least in your personal life, you have a relationship.
Mm.
It's very difficult in a professional setting. But I would say it is like any skill in that, that it improves the more that you do it.
Mm-hmm.
As I've said before, when someone's dying and when you're watching someone you love die, it's a really, really lonely place to be. And in every instance that I've talked about, I've witnessed the difference someone approaching a bed and smiling and asking someone how their day is and how they're feeling, and is, you know, and are they okay? I've noticed the difference it makes. I would argue even more so if there is some sort of physical contact at the same time. And that's very difficult with the pandemic that we've been through, but physical contact is huge in those situations. People need people, and in our darkest moments, we need them most.
Yeah.
And I genuinely believe the only wrong thing to say about dying is just to say nothing at all.
Yeah, completely hear that. And I think, you know, if worse comes to worse and you feel super stuck, just think, you know, if that was yourself or somebody you cared about, you know, sitting in that hospital bed by themselves, what would you want? Presumably not to be, you know, just glossed over because it's awkward. It would be, you know, someone just saying, hey, how are you doing today? Just start with that.
I stood in a clinic waiting to see an oncologist, and a research nurse I work with saw what was happening and came over laid his hands on Michael's shoulder. And that was it. He didn't speak to him. He knew we were waiting to go in and see someone. And that was it. And just that small physical, that human touch of, and in that instance, you know, it's something I've never forgotten. It was such an act of humanity and actually bravery, because he didn't have to come over, but he did, because he could almost sense that we were in pain and struggling. So yeah, it does make a huge difference.
Yeah, I really like how you've described that, like the bravery, because yes, it is hard for everyone involved, but just that little step out there can be so important and can be really felt on the other side. Well, I think, you know, we've talked about quite a lot, and I know that some of this stuff is still quite raw, so thank you so much for sharing that. Is there anything in particular you would really like to convey or for people to hang on to?
No, I think I think at the moment I'm still coming to terms a lot with some of the loss that we've had. But I guess I sit here with you now, and the weather's changing and the sun is shining, and I take my blessings in the fact that I don't, but I'm grateful to be here every day, and I try and look for some kind of positive way forward, and I just really hoped this might be, you know, we're talking about death and dying, but I actually wanted to share all my positive experiences if possible, because I just think they're small things that could make a difference. And I was blessed in that I am a healthcare professional myself. So I had connections other people wouldn't. And I just want to share the difference, you know, the difference it would make. These tiny acts make huge differences at such a difficult time.
Thank you. It's everything you've said is just really powerful. And so hard to fully understand. You can't learn this stuff, you know. It's not going to be in your textbooks. It's just a matter of experiencing real life, isn't it?
So it is.
Thank you so much for sharing, Louise.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.